Welcome to the Debate at G08 podcast series, exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Cantelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer and an alumnus from Adelaide University. Other Group of Eight universities include the universities of Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, Western Australia, the Australian National University, Monash University, and UNSW Sydney. The G08 comprises Australia's leading research-intensive universities, and today we'll be looking at some of the big issues confronting many of them. In the pod booth with me is G08 CEO Vicky Thompson, and speaking to us via Zoom is Professor Ian Jacobs, the Vice-Chancellor of UNSW Sydney. Sadly, Professor Jacobs is leaving the university at the end of the year, but before he does so, we thought it best to tap into some of his key insights about the university sector here in Australia. Well, Professor Ian Jacobs, thanks for your time today. Many of the issues we've dealt with in these podcasts have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. You too have felt that impact, given that it has separated you from your family and is part of the reason you're heading back to the UK next year. Could you tell us a bit about that decision, please?
Yes, well, hello, Ron, and I'm delighted to be joining you for this podcast. And in relation to the pandemic, I should say first that I realise that many people in Australia and around the world have suffered really devastating loss due to the pandemic. And in that context, the impact on me and my family is really not comparable to the level of suffering. But nevertheless, it has, as for so many others, had a big impact, and it's led to difficult but important decisions. And for us, the distance from family and friends, particularly our three children and our parents, as they entered their late 80s, was always a concern for Chris, my wife, and myself. And until last year, we managed with regular trips back to the UK and them visiting us in Sydney, and it worked well for 5 years. And in truth, it provided many special times where we had really memorable extended periods of time together in a way that we wouldn't really have had if we were living close by. Of course, that stopped in early 2020. And then, sadly, in July 2020, my father, who'd become increasingly frail, died in his 90th year, leaving my mother on her own after 65 years of happy marriage. And I was unable to get back for his funeral. That was hard. And like so many others in our situation, I haven't seen our children or my mother for nearly 2 years. And so after careful reflection and agonising at the end of last year, the decision became obvious.
So you've been Vice-Chancellor at UNSW for 7 years, and had COVID-19 not struck, you'd probably have remained there at UNSW until 2025. How do you feel about your decision to head back to the UK and work that you still wanted to see to fruition here?
UNSW has been on a great trajectory for most of its 70-year history. And I feel privileged that by the time I leave, I will have led the university for 10% of that time. And I'm proud of what the UNSW community have delivered during my stint through our 2025 strategy. We've made major improvements in research quality and impact. New approaches to the organisation and delivery of education, a strong focus on equity, diversity and inclusion, and above all, we've lived up to our ethos of using the opportunities and expertise that we have to have a positive impact on people in Australia and globally. And all of that, I believe and hope, has been delivered with a hallmark of my time here, a commitment to partnership and particularly generosity and partnership for the common good. I like to think that that's exemplified by things like SVEAR, the Sydney Partnership for Health, Education, Research and Enterprise, which I led, the New Alliance with universities of Newcastle, Wollongong and Western Sydney, the Plus Alliance with Arizona State and King's College London, the Multiversity now in Western Sydney, and our contribution to national efforts through the Group of Eight and Universities of Australia. And I'm also proud more recently of our response to the pandemic, and I'm sure we'll come on to that. We acted quickly and proactively last year to respond to the massive challenges organisationally and financially. but also importantly with a forward-looking lens to new educational opportunities in lifelong learning, short courses, and new research needs. And one example is our new UNSW RNA Institute. So given the circumstances, I think UNSW is in good shape, and I know it will prosper under the leadership of my successor, Attila Brooks. Attila is a talented, dynamic, experienced leader, and he'll continue the strong trajectory of UNSW as we emerge from the pandemic.
Well, Vicky Thompson, you've worked with Professor Ian Jacobs in many capacities as CEO of the GO8. What sort of legacy has this man left here in Australia?
Well, I think, Ron, I mean, I had the privilege of working with Ian as chair of the Group of Eight Universities, and that's not an easy gig, to be honest. often it's described as herding cats in terms of trying to bring people together. And for me, and I think we've just heard, you know, in Ian's, in his discussion just then, he uses the words around generosity of spirit and collaboration and, you know, there's a great empathy, I think, that Ian has, that he brings and brought to the Group of Eight, certainly brought to UNSW. But I think for me, probably, and this is a legacy which continues at the Group of Eight, is a real drive to be in the solutions business when we're dealing with government and to demonstrate and talk to government about what it is we can offer. And it's this engagement piece. And I guess this is, you know, in many ways why we do these podcasts, and this, the genesis of this kind of discussion that we're having really started with Ian as chair of the Group of Eight, sort of saying, we can't be as adversarial as we often are. You know, when you're in that sort of political bear pit as you often are, let's sort of step back and let's engage people around us who can then be our advocates as sectors, as a university group. But one thing I would say is a lot of people who would be listening and watching these podcasts, many people don't even know what a vice chancellor is or a chancellor is. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, they are the CEO of an organisation and a business as well as a university. And one of Ian's counterparts, Professor Brian Schmidt, often describes it as being, you know, he just leads several thousand consultants who do what they want to do. You know, it's a really tough job. To be able to bring together in the way that Ian has the changes he's made at UNSW is no small challenge. And he's done that and has left not just a legacy, I think, in the Australian context, from the Group of Eight's perspective, but certainly, as he quite rightly said, where UNSW will now go to 2025 and beyond. So for me, it's been a great pleasure to be working with Ian, and, you know, it's a great loss. We've lost a lot of good people through this pandemic for very genuine personal reasons, and this is definitely one of them.
A classic example. But yep. To you, Ian, you talked about the challenges that your university has faced, and we've seen the financial health of many universities challenged. Only recently, Adelaide University announced a $22 million shortfall this year and that growing to $43 million in 2023. It's forecasting a reduction of 130 administrative staff and an undetermined number of academic jobs too. All of this because of COVID and the loss of international students. What's the way out for universities at the moment?
Well, first of all, I just comment that I think overall our sector has responded in an exemplary fashion to the pandemic. Yeah. Every university has delivered education online effectively and at speed. All the organisations are making financial and organisational adjustments in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. They provided financial and psychological support for students and staff facing hardship. And all of that, while being deliberately excluded by government from support and dealing with complex issues related to closed borders and geopolitical tension. So I do think that our universities have done well in these difficult circumstances. The sector is strong, and I am confident that it will emerge strong. And remember, these challenges are not just in Australia. They're affecting universities and actually every organisation in society around the world. So what's the way out for our universities? Well, the pandemic has focused attention on some long-standing issues for the sector. more recently, government's been happy to gradually reduce funding for both education and perhaps even more for research and allow that to be replaced by the entrepreneurial efforts of universities in international education. Not long ago, government and those in the sector celebrated our success in being a major player in international education. There were, of course, sensible concerns about heavy reliance on international educational income and on one source of that income geographically well before the pandemic. Now, at UNSW, we were very clear about the risks. We had plans for addressing a fall in international income, and we implemented them when it was necessary. And the same applies elsewhere in the sector. Going forward, I'd like to see a sensibly balanced portfolio of funding for our universities, and that requires the involvement of government. It is desperately needs a balance of public funding, philanthropy, international education, and industry funding. And that's where we should be heading. Importantly, it must include proper support for research from public funds so that we can drive the discovery, translation, application pipeline. That has to include full economic costing of research and incentives to link universities and industry. It's clearly in the national interest. It will bring social benefits, economic return, jobs, new opportunities. It's all doable. The sums needed are not only small in the context of what's being thrown at the pandemic, but crucially, it will generate a return for the nation and create opportunities for future generations. In my view, as I exit, the higher education sector in Australia is one of the nation's jewels, and it's complete madness not to support and invest in it.
I notice you referred to governments deliberately excluding the universities. Well, how do you get around that problem?
I think it's a phase in time. I cannot imagine that anyone would seriously think it is wise for Australia to damage a sector that it is so effectively built up over 30, 40, 50 years. So I think this is just a phase in time. Those in the sector and those who support the sector outside will keep on making the case. And I'm sure that this will reverse. I think it's just a phase.
I think you're being very optimistic, Ian, in suggesting it's a phase in time, because I think this is a long-term structural problem for us.
Well, there are certainly structural issues that need to be addressed, but it's all doable. And it's so clear that addressing it will bring benefits for people in Australia, whether it's social or economic. I don't particularly want to get into the details of the specific politics, but I think whatever government we have, it is barn door obvious when you look at the rest of the world that where you support universities, it brings so many benefits to the nation. And it's true in a historical context for Australia as well. So I'm optimistic, Vicky. I think we'll get through both the unfortunate funding model that we have now and overcome the pandemic and some of the national political and geopolitical issues. I think the future actually is strong for the Australian higher education sector.
How are the financials for UNSW, given what's happened with the pandemic?
Well, we acted very quickly. We reduced our expenditure to match what we predicted would be the reduce in income. It's not something we wanted to do, but we faced up to it very quickly. We've made sure that we're preserving our strategic direction, and we are in a strong position for 2021. There are major uncertainties about 2022 and 23, because, of course, right now we're once again in lockdown. That's very difficult for so many people, but it also creates uncertainty about our student enrolments in the future. So there will be challenges. How big they'll be in 22 and 23, it's hard to say yet. But I'm looking beyond that. When I look beyond that for the sector, this is an incredibly strong sector. Per capita, Australia is in the top three countries in the world for the strength of its sector. and education in Australia is still incredibly attractive. And there are all sorts of new opportunities that the pandemic's brought to not only provide excellent education for our domestic students, but to provide education for international students in different ways.
To you, Vicky Thompson, though, you've now had more time to assess the financial position of many of the Group of Eight universities. Given what Ian said, are you a bit more optimistic about the long-term financials for many of our unis?
Well, you have to be optimistic, and I think Ian's right. Our universities entered the COVID pandemic in a very strong financial position. I think the sleeper, though, is the slow burn of the damage that is being done in our universities. And so 2020, throughout the COVID pandemic, we responded. Our financials held relatively well. 2021, we're still in a reasonably okay position, but we're seeing job losses, and you've quoted some of those. They're happening across our universities. I think the issue is, as Ian has pointed out, it's what happens in 22, 23, 24, and that's the concern where I probably don't share the same level of optimism that Ian has, not about our capacity to manage it, but about, I guess, governments. And this is a, you know, successive governments have cut funding to universities, and I've had this discussion before where we seem to be a very easy target. And I'm just getting the sense that perhaps government is thinking that, you know, the job losses, yes, they're bad, but they're not that bad, and maybe the university sector should have responded earlier. You know, there's that in many ways that this is what the government thinks this is what universities should have been doing anyway. There is a
sort of enforced discipline.
Exactly. And then there's the argument about, well, change your business model and move online. And Ian's right. Online and a different way of delivery is very important. But at the end of the day, our international students particularly who come to Australia and pay a premium price for a quality education, particularly at a Group of Eight, they want to be on our campuses. They're coming for that education and that research experience, but they're coming for the very brilliant experience they get on campus. And so there's a question about value for money if you're sitting in your apartment in Shanghai or wherever it may be, or in Delhi, doing an online degree. That is not a sustainable solution. It's part of a hybrid mix, no question, but it's not the solution. And we've certainly at the moment got government really wanting us to look at that in a more aggressive way, and we all are. We pivoted very quickly onto online, but whether or not that's sustainable is another thing. So I think I'm a bit sort of not as optimistic. I think we've still got a ways to go in convincing the general population and government that we are an investment and not a cost, and that there are consequences to all of the things that Ian just mentioned in not actually funding our research and our universities in the way that we need to be funded.
Professor Jacobs.
I absolutely agree with Vicky's analysis, and I agree with her concerns about the short to medium term, but I'm very optimistic about the longer term.
Is this debate happening in the UK? Are there similar arguments about, you know, the level of government support, the financial model for universities, or is this a peculiarly Australian thing?
Very similar debates occurring in the UK, but there is one specific area where I before I arrived here and since I've been here, I've seen the UK government is much more sympathetic and supportive and alert to the need for very serious investment in research in order to generate the sort of benefits economically, socially, and in other ways, job opportunities, exports, that Australia and the UK both desperately want. And Vicky is absolutely right that we need to keep making that case to government. I think government will, in the end, respond to it. And that's why in the longer term, I'm optimistic. Australia needs to diversify its economy. Australia's universities are a jewel in making that happen and are sitting there as a great opportunity.
But it strikes me that this debate has been around for a long time, this notion of research and development, tapping into the skills of the university sector, creating new businesses, new industries. It's been around for a long time, and yet so little seems to be done in terms of commercialising university research.
Yes. My explanation for that is that Australia perhaps has not felt that it needed to invest in the gap between discovery research by universities and the commercialization of that research, because it was easy for Australia to generate economic benefit from other things, like mining, for example. So the pressure that the UK and Israel and Singapore and other countries felt was perhaps not there for Australia. That is changing. The nature of the debate is changing. And if the money can be mobilized to put the incentives in place to bridge that gap, to bring our academics who do brilliant discovery research together with industry that knows how to commercialize that research, the prospects are very strong, because there is a wonderful pipeline of discovery research translated into commercial opportunity that sits there waiting for Australia. I'm hopeful that the government, Minister Tudge, it was started by discussions with Minister Tehan, are really serious about investing in that gap and developing real opportunities for commercialization. It's crucial in that process to understand that nothing will happen unless at the same time there is investment in discovery research. The whole pipeline requires really thought through public investment matched by industry and matched by money that universities can mobilise.
So you've been talking about this new research commercialisation fund that should be established to create this pipeline.
Yes, I feel passionately about this. I have shared with anyone that I've had the opportunity to share it with ideas about an Australian translational research fund and network which brings universities and industry together and puts the right incentives in place. I think that could be put together quite quickly, and it will yield real benefits. Universities are not asking for charitable donations. They're asking for incentives which enable us to deliver the return for Australia in terms of economic benefit, jobs, and new opportunities for people across the nation. I'm hopeful that the current discussions going on will lead to something along those lines, and I'm very much looking forward to what's emerging from that. It's been a privilege to be on the Minister's Research Sustainability Working Group, and I hope that very soon we see positive proposals that lead in that direction.
That is something that Ian has been championing from the get-go when he arrived here in 2015. And we really ramped it up when you were chair of the Group of Eight in terms of that missing gap. I mean, we've had this discussion in the Australian context around research commercialisation for a very, very long time. But if ever there was an opportunity to actually make it happen, now is the time. And it is something I think that government is taking seriously, Ian. I think this is, as you quite rightly said, something that many have talked about. We've had many reviews. We've got somebody running that particular process now in Jeff Connolly. He's the CEO of Siemens in Australia. I think it's got a momentum, and there is an understanding. And you know, Ian's point about, you know, Australia resting on the mining industry, that is a really pertinent point, actually. And one of the things that I often think about and talk about is that actually our greatest resource is what's walking on top of the ground, not under the ground. And you know, if you link all of these conversations we have about needing highly skilled people in the workforce, needing to commercialise our research, that happens through people and through our universities. And so that's why we need to be, you know, really couched in that investment part of the economic growth, the turnaround in the economy, rather than a constant cost to government, which is sometimes where we're kind of put.
And this commercialisation of university research goes to the very heart of what the GO8's all about.
Well, you know, we're the big heavy lifters in research. We do 70% of Australia's university research effort. And we do a lot of research commercialisation, can I say, but a small proportion compared to where we should be if you look at sort of OECD levels and other indicators. And look, there are lots of reasons for that, and Ian's articulated a couple of really good ones. The other issue is that 99% of our industry base in Australia are small, medium enterprises. Mm. And so we don't have the big industries that are doing their in-house research and that research commercialisation that does happen in the US and in the UK, where universities can then partner with them. So it's not just about throwing money at the problem, but addressing that valley of death is what we talk about,
yeah.
is where we do need that incentivisation and that assistance from government, from industry and from a university, so we can work together to deliver that.
And it wouldn't be right to suggest that that Australia or the sector has been terrible at this.
No.
It's just that the opportunity is there to grab. There are some great examples. So just take HPV vaccine. Mm. What an incredible contribution to global society, but also an economic benefit. There have been things where we've missed out. The solar technology from UNSW has never really been commercialized by Australia. That's something we shouldn't allow to happen again. But now we have quantum computing, Silicon Quantum Computing Company, with state government, federal government, CBA and Telstra working with UNSW. That's a great example of positive development in the direction of commercialization.
As we wrap things up, Professor Jacobs, I just want to talk about some of your personal research and the work that you've done in the area of ovarian cancer. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you for asking about my research. I've spent most of my career working on developing a screening test for cancer of the ovary. It's a disease, unfortunately, that has a very low survival rate and is responsible for over 100,000 deaths each year worldwide amongst women. And I developed a screening test in the 80s and 90s and then got a very large grant to conduct a massive trial involving 200,000 women in the UK to assess that screening test using a blood test called CA125, interpreted using a Bayesian algorithm and ultrasound scanning, to try and detect ovarian cancer early enough to save lives. And we after 30 plus years of work, we shown that it was acceptable to women. They complied with screening over many years of screening, that if it worked, it could be economically viable, that it did shift, pick up the cancer early and shift the stage of the cancer earlier. All of that led to great hope that it would actually save lives. And sadly, earlier this year, we finally were able to analyze the data from that very large trial. And albeit that the screening performs well in many ways, it does not actually save lives. Now, that is deeply frustrating because so many women each year die from this awful disease. But the study has led to all sorts of progress in understanding ovarian cancer, and it will lead to lots and lots of other advances. That is the way that research progresses. It doesn't always happen in exactly a straight line and the way you expect, but progress is made. And now myself and many others will continue to work until we do have an effective screening test for ovarian cancer. And meanwhile, there are lots of advances in diagnosis and therapy, which are so important and are beginning to gradually improve the outcomes for women unfortunate enough to develop this disease.
So you continue that research when you're back in the UK?
I've continued it throughout my career, and I will continue it and collaborate and work with people across the world.
Well, hopefully we'll see you back in Australia sometime in the near future. It's an amazing legacy that you've left here at UNSW, but also with your ovarian cancer research. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Ron. My wife and myself love Australia. We're proud to be Australian citizens. We will definitely be back, certainly on lots and lots of visits, perhaps to work here again when family situation changes. And who knows, perhaps we'll be living here in the future. I hope so. Thank you so much for giving me the chance to contribute to this podcast series.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.